Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak at this very nice conference. I'm looking forward to learning some new things this week. Today I'm going to tell you about some work which will come out later this month with my collaborators, Eric Doker and Thomas Dumitrescu. And also there's some related work I'll talk about, which is also with Efrat Gertkevitz. And I'm going to tell you about some of the lessons that we've been able to learn by taking another look at SUN Seiberg-Witten geometry. So Seiberg and Witten famously solved for the low energy effective quantum field theory on the Coulomb branch of n equals to 2 super Yang Mills in 4 dimensions. They originally solved for the pure SU2 case, but since then there was a revolution in our ability to solve for the exact low-energy dynamics of quantum field theories with supersymmetry and many other cases of different gauge groups and matter contents have been studied since then. Today, I'm going to revisit the pure SUN solution. So for the entirety of this talk, I'm going to be referring to SUN gauge theory with n equals to 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. And because the Seiberg-Witten solution plays such an integral role in what I want to tell you about, first I want to start by just reviewing its salient features. So the moduli space of n equals to two gauge theory with gauge group SUN in 4 dimensions is known as the Coulomb branch. It is n minus 1 complex dimensional and can be described by in a basis by gauge invariant coordinates, which I'll call un. The u's are related to traces of products of the vector multiplet scalars at weak coupling, but these are good global coordinates on the moduli space. At a generic point on the moduli space, when these u's get BEVs, the SUN gauge symmetry is broken to its Cartan subgroup, and the low energy dynamics are described by n minus 1 abelian vector multiplets, call them A. And the leading interactions of these vector multiplets, so the two derivative action on the moduli space, is entirely determined by a single holomorphic and analytic function known as the prepotential. One important piece of data that the prepotential determines, which will play an important role in what I want to tell you about, is the Kähler potential. The Kähler potential is given in terms of the prepotential by this formula that I've written here, and restricting to the scalar components of these vector multiplets. This is a real function that's a function of the moduli, the UN Coulomb branch coordinates. The Kähler potential determines the metric on the moduli space. In addition, of course, the Kähler potential determines the Lagrangian for the chiral multiplets in the effective theory. And the metric on the moduli space is given simply in this basis by derivatives of the Kähler potential with respect to the vector multiplet scalars. This is identified with the imaginary part of the matrix of holomorphic gauge couplings on the moduli space. And by construction, then both of these objects are positive definite and symmetric. So the solution to the theory would be given by some means of determining this prepotential. And Seiberg and Witten's solution involved determining first a set of 2n minus 2 holomorphic special coordinates, the A and A dual periods, which are holomorphic functions of the moduli, where this A dual period is the dual variable to A. It's the derivative of the prepotential with respect to A in this basis. I guess more properly, these periods are acted on by electromagnetic duality transformations, and so these periods are sections of a symplectic SP 2n minus 2z line bundle over the moduli space. Then the solution is given by identifying these as the periods of a suitable meromorphic one-form known as the Seiberg-Witten differential. And these are the periods on a canonical basis of homology cycles with canonical intersection form of a family of curves. So the ANA dual periods are the period integrals over these cycles. And then, as you can see, I've written the curve for a given value of the moduli here. So for a given value of the moduli, the curve is hyperelliptic and is, as you can see here, it's some 2n degree polynomial. And the moduli determine lower order terms in this polynomial. And then in terms of this data, the Seiberg-Witten differential is given as follows. And I'll just mention right now, throughout the entirety of this talk, I'm basically going to set the strong coupling scale lambda to 1. Okay, so if I know the periods, I can integrate up the periods to get the prepotential, and I've solved for the dynamics of this system. In SU2, the ANA dual periods, of course, here there's just the one set, are given by hypergeometric functions. These were determined in the original paper. So they're determined by the Gauss hypergeometric functions, the two F1s. For higher n, they can be formulated in a number of ways and from a variety of perspectives. One perspective is to formulate them as the solutions to Picard-Fuchs differential equations. So this was considered by Clem, Lurk, and Thiessen, focused on the case SU3 and by others for general n. And in SU3, the solution to the Picard-Fuchs problem can be expressed as Apple F4 functions in certain regions of the moduli space. And so these Apple F4 functions, these are one way to define them, I'm reminding you here, is as an infinite sum of the Gauss hypergeometric functions. That's one way to define them. Furthermore, they take two arguments. In this formula, I'm calling them alpha and beta, and these two arguments, of course, for SU3 will be the two moduli of SU3. And so one of our key results, which I'd like to highlight today and apply today, is a simple exact Taylor series expansion for the periods for general SUN near the origin of the moduli space. And this Taylor series expansion generalizes these earlier results for n equal SU2 and SU3. So this is, I think, a nice computation and some nice formalism, but I'd like to really emphasize that I think you can learn something with such a computation. And so I'd like to highlight two applications throughout this talk. The first application follows from the fact that the region near the origin where we obtain this Taylor series expansion for the periods is at strong coupling. So in particular, in the strong coupling region for the SUN theory, we know the spectrum of BPS states in the theory. We know their charges. And so then we know their masses as determined by the charges and the ANA dual periods. So, so we can study this spectrum of states throughout the strong coupling region before we hit walls of marginal stability using these expansions. Of course, these BPS states can decay on walls of marginal stability. For example, in SU2, there's a wall of marginal stability surrounding the origin of moduli space. Here I'm plotting this wall in the complex U-plane. And this wall separates the strong coupling spectrum from the weak coupling spectrum, or the spectrum that persists out to semi-classical infinity. And here, these red dots are the monopole and dyon points, which are known to lie on the boundary of this region. So this was, of course, studied in the original paper, and this particular form of the curve was found by these authors. And so this is all to say that a general motivating question for for this work is that whether we can obtain more insight into the border of the strong coupling region for higher n, which is, of course, a much more complicated situation. Secondly, another application I'd like to highlight follows from the fact that the Kähler potential of SUN Seiberg-Witten theory plays a distinguished role in the following Suzy breaking scenario. So the observation is that I can interpolate between n equals to 2 super Yang-Mills gauge theory with, again, we're taking our gauge group SUN, and a non-supersymmetric gauge theory with, again, gauge group SUN, and with two adjoint Val fermions that transform in the adjoint representation of the gauge group, by simply adding this soft supersymmetry breaking operator, which is a non-holomorphic mass term for the vector multiplet scalar in the n equals to 2 theory. So I'm basically just deleting those scalars, and I get this non-supersymmetric gauge theory at low energies when this supersymmetry breaking scale that I'm calling M is much larger than the strong coupling scale of the n equals to 2 theory. And so this is an interesting non-supersymmetric gauge theory. Standard lore suggests that at low energies, it might be in a phase in which the fermion bilinear condenses. And if this is the case, it would lead to the properties of chiral symmetry breaking and confinement. However, it's not completely known what this theory does, and it would be interesting to see if we could constrain its IR physics. And so this leads to the general motivating question of, can we use this embedding of this non-supersymmetric gauge theory in the n equals to 2 supersymmetric theory to constrain the IR phase of this QFT? And again, I'm mentioning this now in the context of this talk because the Kähler potential plays a distinguished role in this story. In fact, the Suzy breaking deformation that I wrote for you on the previous slide, this non-holomorphic mass term for the vector multiplet scalars, can actually be tracked onto the Coulomb branch of the n equals to 2 theory because it lies in a protected multiplet of supersymmetry. And it is identified exactly with the Kähler potential on the moduli space. So in this way, the global structure of the Kähler potential in the n equals to 2 theory can inform us about the possible vacuum structure of adjoint QCD, which is what I'm going to call that this gauge theory with NF equals to 2 adjoint Val fermions. So those are my general motivations in this talk. And so for the outline of the rest of this talk, firstly, I'm going to explain and show this Taylor expansion for the ANA dual periods near the origin of the Coulomb branch. Secondly, I'm going to tell you what we can learn about the Kähler potential, starting with some review for SU2, but then, of course, focusing on general lessons we might learn both analytically and numerically for higher n using our formulas. Then I'll move on to some of these applications. So I'd like to analyze the walls of marginal stability near the strong coupling chamber in SU3. This will be a preliminary analysis. It's by no means complete, but a proof of concept that this is something interesting that can be explored. And finally, time permitting, I will return to this soft supersymmetry breaking application and explain to you the implications of what we've learned about the Kähler potential and strong coupling spectrum for this soft supersymmetry breaking problem. Are there questions before I continue? Maybe. Okay, cool. Okay, so first for the series expansion of the periods. Okay, so we're going to expand these periods about the origin of moduli space. At the origin, where all of the moduli are set to zero, the curve is given as follows by just x to the 2n minus 1. Again, I'm setting the strong coupling scale to 1. And evidently, this is invariant under z2n rotations of the x-coordinates, so I'm going to sometimes refer to this as the Z2n symmetric point or the Z2n symmetric curve. And the branch points of this curve at the origin are the 2nth roots of unity, obviously. So for example, I've plotted these for SU3 in this figure, and I'm also showing in this figure the SU3 specialization of our conventions that we'll use for the computation. So I have to specify consistent branch cuts between the branch points, which I've done here between subsequent branch points. And I have to specify my basis of canonical homology cycles, which I can do as I did here. I'm defining A hat cycles around the branch cuts and B cycles connecting subsequent series of branch cuts, and the A cycles, which have canonical intersection form with the B cycles, are given by sums over these A hat cycles. So basically, we're just choosing to compute in a basis which is maximally Z2n symmetric. That'll make our lives easier. Of course, I could change bases, and changing bases would correspond to electric magnetic duality transformations on the coordinates. So then, by inspection, the periods at the origin are going to be entirely determined by these integrals over the Seiberg-Witten differential up to these branch points. And so the A periods are going to be given by sums over differences of these integrals, and the A dual periods will be given by the appropriate differences of these integrals. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to present a series expansion of this integral, which completely determines the A and A dual periods. So to present the result, you don't have to, please don't get bogged down in detail on this slide. I'm showing you the equations mostly to be definitive. But we find a Taylor series expansion for these integrals, Q, which depend on the branch points, in powers of the moduli. So in particular, I have n minus 1 infinite sums over the various powers of the n minus 1 complex moduli with some coefficient, which depends on the branch point in question, which, remember, is a 2nth root, one of the 2n roots of unity. I've written the exact formula for this coefficient for completeness, but its specific n dependence isn't so important here. The things I'd like to point out are, first of all, that this form of the expansion is optimal in the sense that the coefficient of each monomial in the moduli consists of a single factorized expression. So that's nice. And the second thing I'd like to point out are that these functions are manifestly a non-trivial generalization of the Apple functions. So we hadn't seen this particular generalization, these functions studied before, but we found them very useful.
Is there anything tricky that goes into that computation?
Conceptually, no, but many non-trivial manipulations. it took some effort to derive, but I wouldn't say there was anything conceptually too tricky. We had to massage the terms, so we're expanding in these moduli, and we had to massage the integrals over the differentials in such a way that we could actually do the integrals. So that was the difficult part, finding an expression in terms of integrals that we could actually do. Yeah. You could rewrite this in different ways, yeah. there's not a particular reason I've written it in this way. No, thank you. Obviously, the various of us who have gone through this computation ourselves found, you know, the equivalent expression by doing different manipulations. It's the same. Yeah. So written in this form, I think it's difficult to see, but maybe written in some other forms, I'll show you soon. It's a little easier to see what's going on. Maybe I'll point out as I go on. So I'll continue making some comments on this result. So the first comment is that, okay, that looked very complicated and non-intuitive on the previous slide, but it simplifies on certain slices or for certain values of n. And so in particular, you can show on the slice parameterized only by a single modulus, the first modulus, so a single complex variable, the functions drastically simplify, and I'm left with only two coefficients I have to compute to two of the powers of 2nth roots of unity that appear. And these two coefficient functions reduce just to Gauss hypergeometric functions in the single modulus. So here the argument of the Gauss hypergeometric function is this only non-zero modulus U naught squared. And so this is very nice on such a slice because, of course, we have full analytic control of the Gauss hypergeometric functions. So we can, on these slices, really determine the periods on the full moduli space by various analytic continuations. And so also, obviously, for the case of SU2, this is the easiest way to see that I'm going to get out my known hypergeometric functions for the periods of that case, because in that case, I only have this single modulus. But more generally, this is some slice in the n minus 1 complex dimensional moduli space where I have full control. Next, I'll show you that, of course, as expected, for SU3, I reproduce the Apple functions. So for instance, in SU3, I have two complex moduli. These are commonly called U and V in the literature. So I'll change variables to U and V to show SU3 expressions. And so to remind you that the curve for SU3 looks like this. And so in this case, I can decompose the nicest way to see how these periods look is to decompose that Taylor series into coefficients of irreducible representations of the Z6 symmetry. So maybe this partially answers Ibu's question, which is, I think, the most intuitive way to look at these coefficients is in terms of irreducible representations of the Z2n symmetry, in which case some formulas in some cases simplify. And here, for this SU3 case, I get four independent functions, which are all Apple F4 functions, functions of, in this case, U cubed and V squared, the coordinates on the moduli space. One of these Q hats is zero, and I haven't written for you Q hat zero because the coefficient to the zeroth power of a branch point is going to cancel out of any of the differences for the periods. Maybe interestingly, that's the only one that can't be written as an Apple F4 function, that coefficient, but it's irrelevant for the period computation, so we don't need it. And then you can check that these exactly reproduce the Apple functions that were found on certain regions of the moduli space by Clem, Larkin, Thiessen. So I should comment on the convergence of this expansion. The region of absolute convergence of the Apple function in terms of the SU3 variables here is given by this inequality. So in particular, the region of absolute convergence extends out in the V equals zero slice to the multi-monopole points. The multi-monopole points are the points in SUN moduli space where a maximal number of n minus 1 mutually local dions become massless at once. These are the direct generalization of the monopole and the dion points for SU2 to SUN. So for SU3, there's three such points defined by some U cubed equals 1 formula. And the physics at each point is completely identical. And then in the U equals 0 plane, the region of absolute convergence extends out to the Argyris-Douglas points. So these are, in the SU3 moduli space, two points, defined by, in our conventions, v squared equals 1, where three mutually non-local dions become, or sorry, three mutually local dions become massless at once, and it's well known that the physics of these points is as CFTs. Those are known as the Argyris-Douglas points. And so both sets of interesting points form part of the boundary of the region of absolute convergence. We can then analytically continue these functions to certain regions. We can use the form of the Apple F4 function in terms of hypergeometric functions to analytically continue to large U and small v, and vice versa to large v and small u. But there is no such known analytic continuation in the whole UV planes. On special slices, however, when one of the two is zero, then evidently the Apple F4 functions reduce to hypergeometric functions, and we have full control of the analytic continuation. And again, on these slices, I can really globally determine the periods by suitable analytic continuations. Okay, so that's one of our main results. And now I'd like to use those results to study the Kähler potential of the SUN theory. So the Kähler potential, in terms of the ANA dual periods, is determined by this formula. Remember, it's a real function of the moduli, expressing the periods as holomorphic functions of the moduli. And nicely, in terms of the decomposition of this integral Q into irreducible Z2n representations. So this is the SUN analog of the SU3 decomposition I just utilized on the previous slide. Then the nice result is that the Kähler potential takes a diagonal form. So this just takes some heavy manipulations of substituting these infinite series into this formula. And so we've studied the form of that potential. Another useful quantity, which we utilized in some of our analysis, is the derivative of the Kähler potential with respect to the moduli. So this is also a useful thing to have some analytic control over for what I want to say next. And this derivative can be computed using the identification of the derivatives of the Seiberg-Witten 1 form with the holomorphic abelian differentials of the first kind. So by construction, the derivatives of the Seiberg-Witten differential are given by a basis of these holomorphic abelian differentials plus exact pieces, and which will fall away in the period integrals. And so the derivatives of the ANA dual periods can be expressed as period integrals over these abelian differentials. And then we can exploit this and use manipulations similar to those used to prove the Riemann bilinear relations to recast the derivatives of the Kähler potential with respect to the moduli as surface integrals rather than double period integrals. The form is highlighted here in this green box. And I'm telling you this because in addition to some analytic applications, writing the derivatives in this form is actually very useful for numerical evaluations of the Kähler potential. So this is a formula that I can integrate up in Mathematica in order to compute the Kähler potential for SU3, for example, as I'll do in just a minute. Of course, it would be nice if we could just plug Apple functions into Mathematica or Maple, but these numerical methods don't work so well in that way. Yeah. I don't have a good intuition. I think it's interesting that it came out that way. It's obviously like the clearest expression for the Kähler potential in terms of these series, but I guess I don't have a particularly good physical intuition. Sorry, if someone couldn't hear, maybe they could hear.
The people in chat said repeat questions.
Sorry. So the question was whether there's a nice reason that the Kähler potential had to take this diagonal form, and if there's a way to understand this. And I said that I don't have good physical intuition, although, of course, it is very nice. Maybe it would be nice to get a deeper understanding of this. Okay, so with these considerations and others, let me tell you what the Kähler potential looks like, starting with a warm-up of SU2, which the SU2 case was already previously known. So for SU2, here, this plot I'm making is a plot of the Kähler potential in the complex U-plane. Of course, for SU2, this is very easy. I can just plot the hypergeometric functions. And I'm showing on this plot the monopole and dion points for reference. And I'm also showing the k equals 0 contour in black on this plot. So in particular, k is convex with a single global minimum at the origin of moduli space. And it's negative in some region around the origin, and then positive outside of this region around the origin. And these are plots that have been made by other people. Now, for higher n, we'd like to see to what extent these features remain true. So the first comment is that you can show analytically using the derivatives of K formula I showed you on the last slide, that the symmetric point at the origin is indeed a stationary point of the Kähler potential. Of course, I would have expected this, but you can prove this for SUN. And it's the value of the Kähler potential at this point is, that's easy to compute. And I didn't write it because it's just a little bit long, but it scales like minus n squared.
Is the value of K a meaningful quantity?
I think let's see. In a vacuum, no, but for applications, yes. So if I'm matching the Kähler potential onto some application, like the Suzy breaking application I'm going to talk about later, then its value is important because it tells me something about the potential of some.
So if this wasn't special geometry, if it was just Kähler geometry, then K can be shifting arbitrarily.
Yes. That's a very important point. So the question was whether, so the comment was that if this wasn't special geometry, if this was just regular Kähler geometry, then the Kähler potential could shift when I shift the A and A dual periods by a constant. It wouldn't be invariant. Let me think. So for special Kähler geometry, I think it could still shift. But in n equals 2 theories, we have the additional constraint when I know certainly for n equals 2 theories with a good Sonius stress tensor multiplet that the Kähler potential has to be single valued. And indeed, in these cases, the Kähler potential is a single valued function. But a general Kähler potential isn't single valued. But that's important here, that what I'm showing is meaningful because these Kähler potentials are single valued in these n equals to 2 theories. Okay, thank you for the question. So that's the comment about the symmetric point. Furthermore, we see that there's some region around the origin for which K remains negative. And in general, it's pretty easy to show that the multi-monopole points are going to lie on the boundary of this region. K is 0 at the multi-monopole points. And so, for instance, I can show you explicit pictures for SU3 where I can numerically integrate these derivatives of the Kähler potential, which is how I generated this plot that I'm showing here. So, as you can see, it looks convex. You can see the minimum at the origin. Here I'm showing some slice in the real U and real V-plane at U equals imaginary parts of these variables equal to zero. But of course, I can generate other slices. This is just a nice illustrative slice. Because on this slice, I can see, firstly, one of the multi-monopole points, the one at real U, non-zero. It lies on the K equals zero contour, which in this plane I've drawn as this black line. And also in this plane, or in this slice, I can see the Argyris-Douglas points at real U equals zero, but real V is plus or minus one. And the Argyris-Douglas points actually do lie in the negative K region. So we computed their value. They lie at K negative within this contour. But they're explicitly not minima of the Kähler potential. So for example, for SU3, I just showed you that I have this region of negative K around the origin. And I can visualize the boundary of this region for which K is negative by numerically plotting these K equals zero contours on slices. So in this plot, what I'm showing for illustrative purposes is the K equals zero contour in the complex U plane. So at various values of V. So you should think the Kähler potential is negative within these circles and then positive outside of these circles. The outermost circle is the V equals zero circle on which I have the three multi-monopole points, which I've indicated on the figure by the red dots. And then as I increase V, the Kähler potential lifts until it is entirely positive above about V is 2.1. And that's just something we saw, like we found numerically from these formulas. So I've harped a lot on the negativity of the Kähler potential in some region. And one reason that this is particularly interesting is because we've proven that actually K is negative at an arbitrary stationary point of the Kähler potential. So if there were some other stationary point away from the minimum at the origin, it would have to occur at one of these, at some finite region away from the origin where K is negative. So this restricts our search if we're looking, for example, if we're trying to understand stationary points of the Kähler potential. And it is natural to conjecture, based on this evidence, that in fact the Kähler potential is everywhere convex, such that the origin is the unique minimum. And despite our very best efforts, we have still been unable to prove this statement analytically. we have proven this statement on some special slices. We've made some progress on special slices for SUN. And we have very good numerical evidence for N equals 3 by making these sorts of plots over and over and over and over again. But as it stands, this is a conjecture. If you have an idea of how to prove this conjecture, I'd be very happy to talk to you. Okay, doing good on time. Okay, so next, let me tell you briefly about an application to computing candidate walls of marginal stability in SU3. So this discussion follows from the fact that, of course, the periods determine the masses of heavy BPS states in my theory. The central charge is equal to the vector of electric and magnetic charges dotted with the vector of A and A dual periods, and the mass of the BPS state is equal to the length of this vector. And in general, a BPS state can decay into other BPS states or is marginally at the threshold of marginally being able to do this when charge conservation and mass conservation are satisfied, which can be reformulated as the statement that the phases of the central charges of the BPS states involved in this decay process are equal. So the condition for marginal stability for a BPS state to be on the threshold to decay into other BPS states, or conversely, for those BPS states to be on the threshold to form a marginally stable bound state, is that their phases are the same. And then for a given charge assignment of electric and magnetic charges, this condition carves out a real codimension one subspace of the moduli space in general. So in SU2, this consideration yields this nice curve that I plotted back in the introduction, which divides the SU2 moduli space into a strong coupling region and a weak coupling region, where the spectrum of stable states jumps discontinuously. In the strong coupling region, I have the stable states are precisely the monopole and the dyon that become massless at the corresponding singular points. And then in the weak coupling region, I have W bosons and a spectrum of dyons, which must decay into the monopole and the dyon once they cross this wall of marginal stability. And one comment is that this curve of marginal stability in the U-plane exactly coincides with the k equals 0 contour. It's just you can obviously see that this condition that the phases are the same for the central charges in this case is the fact that is equivalent to the condition that the Kähler potential is 0. So this is, in particular, the exact same curve I plotted in my SU2 plot of the Kähler potential earlier. Now, in the generalization to larger n, there are many different curves of marginal stability and much more interesting and rich phenomena. And I will give no attempt to do some complete study of this phenomena. But so for SUN, we know the spectrum of BPS states in some regions of moduli space. And one of the things we know the spectrum of stable BPS states in the strong coupling chamber right around the origin. And the statement is that there are n towers of n minus 1 mutually local dyons. I'll label them by these mu km, and I'm kind of representing each of the n towers with n minus 1 components here. And these are structured so that one member of each tower becomes massless at each of the n multi-monopole points. So it really is a direct generalization of the SU2 case in terms of what's happening with the spectrum there. So you can see this by here I've written the masses of these stable BPS states right at the origin, right when all the u's are 0. And the statement is that these follow some sine law at the origin. I've schematically plotted the spectrum or the levels of this spectrum at the origin of moduli space here. So since they follow this sine law with some n-dependent coefficient, which is order 1 in n, the lightest of these BPS states is like order lambda over n, and the heaviest has a mass of about order lambda. And then you can show that exactly one member of each of these levels, or really two, because the levels are twofold degenerate because of the sine symmetry, come down and become massless at the multi-monopole points. So at each multi-monopole point, a different member of each tower becomes massless. And then at the multi-monopole point, there's some gap to the heavy BPS states at that point in moduli space. This gap goes like lambda over n squared. This was discussed, for example, by Douglas and Shanker. Okay, so this is what we know about the SUN strong coupling spectrum. Let's now specialize to SU3 to do some examples. And just for completeness, I'll show you that in our chosen basis, the strong coupling states in SU3 have central charges, which are given by this formula. And in our basis, using this basis of cycles that I showed you earlier, you can compute what the charges would be of the six heavy states. And in this table, I've divided them into the three pairs, each pair becoming massless at one of the three multi-monopole points. And so now I'd like to apply our formulas to the periods to studying marginal stability of these states. And I really want to emphasize that I'm in no way doing a complete analysis here. I'm going to look at some very special slices where I have this full analytic control of the periods from our formulas and see what candidate walls there are. And so in particular, I'll look at the U equals zero and V equals zero slices. So two real dimensional slices. On the V equals zero slice, by inspection of our formulas, you can actually see that you can relate two of the periods to the other two, and then rewrite the central charge formula in terms of just one set of periods. And the coefficients to this one set of periods are integers, it turns out. And as such, the problem of studying marginal stability of these states on this particular slice is completely identical to the SU2 problem. And in particular, then, the k equals 0 contour on this slice coincides with the wall of marginal stability. And so that's what I've plotted here. I've plotted this k equals 0 contour, which is the wall of marginal stability in this range. And of course, again, the three multi-monopole points lie on this slice. So that's very nice. More interesting, perhaps, is let's look at the U equals zero slice. Now on this slice, the periods are also related to each other. They also satisfy relations, but these relations are given in terms of complex non-integers. So even though the problem is now specified by just one set of periods, the problem is not identical to SU2 because the coefficients to these periods in the central charge formula are not necessarily integer. You can study the condition that the phases of the central charges of these states align and thereby identify candidate walls or lines of marginal stability in this plane. And if you do so, you find this plot. So what you find is here I've shown the two Argyris-Douglas points in this plane. And these colored curves are curves on which pairs of the strong coupling BPS states satisfy the marginal stability condition. So these are candidate lines of marginal stability. Interestingly, some of these curves intersect with the k equals zero contour, which is not a wall of marginal stability on this plane, but which, for completeness, I've plotted on this diagram. So this is some interesting, I think, application of our formulas, and I think it'd be interesting to do a more complete study of the walls of marginal stability in this chamber of moduli space. Okay. Oh, good, so I have 10 minutes, is that true? Okay. In just the last 5 minutes, I'm going to return to this application to soft supersymmetry breaking I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, where I'll remind you that the setup I have in mind is to flow from n equals to 2 super Yang Mills with gauge group SUN to NF equals to 2 adjoint QCD by means of this mass term for the vector multiplet scalars. So at small m, so small Suzy breaking, when it's really reliable to just expand about, basically to expand in Seiberg-Witten theory, as I told you at the beginning of this talk, the Kähler potential determines the Suzy breaking potential on the moduli space. So the Suzy breaking potential is just the Kähler potential. And so I can import the discussion I had earlier about the Kähler potential in SUN gauge theory to say that our evidence then suggests that this potential has a single stable minimum at the origin of moduli space. And if this is true, then the Suzy breaking, suggestion would be that the non-supersymmetric QFT would have a vacuum corresponding to this minimum at the origin. And I can expand around this vacuum and see what its physical properties are. And if I did that, I would find that this vacuum is in the Coulomb phase with unbroken chiral symmetry. So, of course, first comment is that this is only reliable at very small values of the Susie breaking scale. The second comment is that this would be a very, very surprising conclusion if we think that this is the whole story and that this phase persists to larger M. And so if this QFT does confine and break chiral symmetry breaking, we learn that there must be a phase transition away from this small M phase at larger M. So I'd like to argue that that's not the end of the story. And a clue for what's happening as we increase M comes from our understanding of the stable BPS states in the strong coupling chamber. So remember, as I reviewed for you a few slides ago, in the strong coupling chamber, I have these N towers of N minus one stable states. And one member of each tower becomes massless at each of the multi-monopole points. So at this vacuum at the origin, one naively would expect that when I dial up my Susie breaking scale to about the mass of this first stable BPS state that I haven't included in my light physics, that this minimum is no longer reliable. I've encountered physics that I didn't include in the effective description, and I might not. And I might need to include it. Now, since these states do become light at the multi-monopole points, this suggests that perhaps by expanding near these points in moduli space, expanding the Susie breaking deformation near these points, where the effective description includes these light degrees of freedom, we might access this new physics. So this is some motivation to consider a dual description of the large M physics by expanding near the multi-monopole points. And near the multi-monopole points on the moduli space, the light fields, these light monopoles, are captured by an effective Abelian-Higgs model, which is in an S-dual frame to the description at other non-singular points on the moduli space. And in particular, the light fields of this model are the Abelian vector multiplet scalars, which are identified with the A-dual periods at this point on moduli space, and hypermultiplet scalars, which are describing the monopoles becoming light at these points. And they're coupled in some Abelian Higgs model. I'm not giving details here. I'm just trying to give an overview of how one might analyze this problem, which we have indeed analyzed in our upcoming paper. And so doing so, again, the Kähler potential plays an integral role in this story because the Susie breaking potential flows to the Kähler potential, but now it's the Kähler potential which is matched onto by integrating out the light monopoles near this point in moduli space. But the point I'd like to emphasize is that, again, in this case, the Kähler potential will determine the couplings in this Susie breaking potential and therefore inform the proposed vacuum structure for this non-supersymmetric QFT. Okay, so this is my, I think I'm okay on time. This is my last slide. So this is a long story, and please feel free to ask me about it for details later, but I will just end by summarizing the main findings from doing this analysis that I motivated. And the findings are that at small values of the Susie breaking scale, the theory is again found to be in a Coulomb phase, which is stable only up to some particular value of the Susie breaking scale. As I increase the Susie breaking scale, what happens is the monopoles become activated. They get vacuum expectation values pairwise in a series of first order phase transitions. And so at first, just one pair turns on, and then another pair, and then another pair. The ordering of this pair is determined by by matching to the Kähler potential in Seiberg-Witten theory. And ultimately, the phase which persists and is stable to large M has all of these hypermultiplet VEVs turned on, you can show that it's a confining phase. In particular, the Zn one-form symmetry is unbroken. And you can also show that this is a chiral symmetry breaking phase and in lots of other nice properties. And I'll just highlight that what you find doing this analysis is that these first phase transitions indeed can be shown to map to the values of the first sets of BPS states, which were heavy at the origin of moduli space. So this is really jiving with our intuition that we're capturing these degrees of freedom as they became light at the multi-monopole points. At these phase transitions, more and more of the monopoles are participating in the physics and leading to these conclusions. Okay, so I'll just end with a quick summary. So in this talk, I revisited the famous Seiberg-Witten solution to n equals 2 SUN gauge theory in four dimensions. And I explained our result of a useful Taylor series expansion for the periods in the strong coupling chamber of moduli space. And then using this and some other results, I computed and analyzed the Kähler potential for general n in this region of moduli space and provided some evidence for the conjecture that the minimum of this Kähler potential at the origin is the unique minimum. Then I gave some applications for these formulas. Firstly, as at least a proof of concept application, I applied these to an analysis of candidate walls of marginal stability on some slices of the SU3 moduli space. And finally, I summarized very briefly how the SUN Kähler potential plays a distinguished role in this soft supersymmetry breaking story and can inform, possibly, the low energy phase structure of adjunct QCD. So with that, I'll end. Thank you very much. New phenomena for in which story?
Well, you did mostly SU3. I wonder whether at large n you anticipate new phenomena.
Yes, so new phenomena in which sense or in which application do you have in mind?
Well, personally, I'm most interested in the allowed phases, but I can ask the same question about.
Good. So in the supersymmetry breaking story I presented here, we actually have an analysis for all n, and in particular, we've also analyzed the large n limit of many of the quantities we've seen. And what we found is that SU3 is very similar to like SUN in the extent that it can be. and so this structure of different phase transitions and how they scale with n is very rich and interesting, and indeed is a story which is quite different in some respects from the SU2 story, which is almost too simple to see a lot of these interesting physics. Yeah. Thank you for the question.
Can you explain why, when you're taking M large, you can trust this analysis, especially where the walls are?
Good. So, okay. So, firstly, with regard to the walls of marginal stability, I didn't need to really understand too much about the walls of marginal stability to say things about the Suzy breaking story. I just needed to know about the multi-monopole points, which of course lie on such walls. So that's the first comment. However, in this analysis, firstly, strictly speaking, I have no control at large M. So strictly speaking, I could have gotten garbage. And the fact that I don't get garbage, instead I get this very, very nice story with lots of structure, and in particular, structure that matches on to the structure of these BPS states at the origin of moduli space, I think is a hint that we've really captured enough degrees of freedom in the system that it works better than it should. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but yes, strictly speaking, I have no control at large M in that story. However, the fact that I motivated, that I have all of these like light degrees of freedom that were very heavy in order lambda masses in the at the origin of moduli space, I think is the reason that it's actually working so well. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I got confused about these multi-monopole points. Could you go back to section 3? The V is equal to 0 slice?
Yeah.
This, so I was confused. So what are these red dots here?
These are the multi-monopole points. So here I have the U-plane, and I'm plotting a contour in the U-plane, which both coincides with the K equals 0 contour, and a wall of marginal stability in this plane, or at least a slice of a wall of marginal stability that lives in this plane. And I'm pointing out that at V equals 0 and U equals the third roots of unity, these are the points in moduli space, which are the multi-monopole points. And so at these points specifically, I have the sets of particles becoming light. And these lie on this line of marginal stability.
Which, this is for the SU3 theory?
This is for SU3, yes.
Shouldn't there be 3 points like that?
Should there what?
Shouldn't there be 3 multi-monopole points?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I think you just can't see the bottom one.
Oh,
I'm... He's down there.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Never mind. I get it. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.